Everybody, welcome back to the Course on Atlas Shrugged. I was away last week at the Mises University. It was a very nice conference. I'll just tell you a couple stories from the conference that I thought were pretty good. There was a lecture, a very good lecture by Roderick Long, and a student asked him whether he thought that Mises, when he was talking about the a priori, was more influenced by Kant or Fritsche. And neither Roderick nor I could identify Fritsche. I think it was just a made up, the person had confused. He must have been thinking of some other philosopher, but I get you to just made up the name. It reminded me once years ago I was sitting in a restaurant in Los Angeles and I was reading a philosophy book. Someone came over to me and said, "Oh, I see you're interested in philosophy. I've always been interested in the philosophy of Max Buber." I think he was thinking of maybe a Martin Buber, but it wasn't. I'm not sure who the person meant. But the other funny thing, another funny thing that happened at the conference is we have at the end, there's a final oral exam. So what we do in the exam, I think there are about 30 people who qualify, and then they're divided into panels where three or four faculty will examine some of the students, divided into groups, and then each panel will select the two best, and then those people are examined by the whole faculty. The situation is at the end, there's a student who comes in, and there are about 12 faculty people sitting around at the table. So the first student came in, and he sat at the front, and he said that, "You're probably wondering why I called you all together here." I thought it was a pretty good joke, but he didn't win any of the top awards. I don't think that lost it for him. Okay, now today we're going to be talking about a central element in Atlas Shrugged and also in objectivist philosophy, Rand's theory of ethics. Now, one thing about her ethics is, when you're reading Atlas Shrugged, remember I said in the previous two lectures that Rand regarded metaphysics and epistemology, or theory of knowledge, as really the foundational parts of philosophy. These were the most essential structural parts, and then the rest of the system develops from that. But let's imagine a reader who, let's say, didn't have any previous knowledge of objectivist philosophy, who was just reading Atlas Shrugged as a novel. Well, they might notice a little bit about the philosophy, since she has the parts have these Aristotelian titles, that A is A, and so on. But it would be easy to read the novel and not really pay attention to any of the metaphysical or epistemological implications of the book. But one thing you couldn't ignore is Rand's ethics. This is really central to the plot. So it's imperative if we're going to understand the novel if we grasp her ethical system. Now, objectivists make a fundamental claim about ethical system. They say that ethical system can be divided into two categories. Those that are based on individual self-interest and those that support sacrifice to a collective or to other people. So we have a basic contrast between egoism and altruism. I don't think you need to guess which side Rand is on and which side is favored in Atlas Shrugged. So there's an apparent problem with this claim that the ethical theories can be divided into these two categories, individual self, both based on individual self-interest, and those that support sacrifice to a collective. And what is this problem? Well, it would be something like this. Suppose I say that all colors can be divided into white and black, taking white and black to be colors. Sometimes people don't get it even colors. Suppose you said all colors can be divided into white and black. Well, what would be the problem there? You might take white and black as the furthest possible ones apart. They're kind of logically contrary, but that leaves a lot of room in between. If we said something like all colors can be divided, or say something, not something like, but say exactly all colors can be divided into white and not white, that would be true. That would be an application of the law of non-contradiction. But we couldn't say all colors are divided into white and black. It would be something to say, well, we say all political philosophies are divided into libertarian and communist. That wouldn't work. We could say all political philosophies can be divided into libertarian and non-libertarian. We couldn't just pick two extremes and say these divide up the field. There can be intermediate ones falling in between. So in similar fashion, we could object to the division that Rand is giving. We could say, well, besides systems, her system or other systems that say stress based on individual self-interest, and besides systems that are based on sacrifice to other people, couldn't you have intermediate systems? For example, suppose you have kind of a standard act utilitarianism system saying what the basic requirement of ethics is to maximize the good, where sometimes that will call for you to sacrifice yourself to others, other times it won't. So couldn't you have systems that are intermediate between those based on individual self-interest and those based on sacrifice to occur collective? Are the objectivists wrong in saying that systems have to fall into one of these two classes? Are they confusing what in logic is called the contradictory, where you say A and not A, where that is an exhaustive classification, just as you say white and not white, or libertarian and non-libertarian? You could say egoist and non-egoist is an exhaustive classification. Any system would have to fall under one of those two categories. But so are they confusing that with contrary opposition, which is the opposition between two extremes, where you're allowed, it doesn't take account of possible things in the middle? Now, I think the objectivist could give two replies to this sort of objection. One is, they could say, well, it's true there's this possibility of intermediate systems that aren't completely either egoistic or altruistic, but these two are the most important systems. This is a really fundamental conflict, and that's what they want to claim. Then another claim they could make is, any which they have made, is any intermediate system. Suppose you said, let's take the example I gave of a utilitarian system that says you're trying to maximize the good, so that doesn't say, well, you're always required to sacrifice yourself for the collective. It doesn't say, on the other hand, you should always put your self-interest first. Seems to favor neither. So they would say, well, it's true that system doesn't say you have to sacrifice yourself, but since it isn't putting the individual self-interest first, it's saying there's some cases in which the individual might have to sacrifice himself or herself, where the individual isn't putting his own self-interest first. So they would take that to be a form of altruism. So what they want to say is anything that isn't completely egoistic counts as a form of altruism. So they would reply to this objection that their division is confusing contrary opposition with contradictory opposition, is that they want to take anything that isn't egoistic in the sense they think proper as a form of altruism. Now, I think Rand's criticism of altruism is the view that what the aim of ethics, what you should be trying to do if you want to be good or do what's right, is to sacrifice yourself for other people or for some collective body. I think her criticism of that is one of her greatest contributions. I want to say a little bit about some of the consequences of collectivist morality in the 20th century, which I'm old enough to remember a good part of the 20th century, probably unlike many out in the audience. If we look at 20th century history and history of previous centuries also, we can see that collectivist morality has had disastrous consequences. For example, if we look at the Nazis, remember Hitler was in power from January 1933 till his downfall in 1945. So the Nazi slogan perfectly exemplifies Rand's notion of altruism, because their slogan was the common good before the individual good. So the individual had to, if necessary, sacrifice himself for the good of the master race, or people that the Nazis thought were inferior had to be sacrificed for the good of the master race. So if someone said that, why do I have to join the army and fight on the Eastern Front? Hitler would have said, you're required to do this because this is what is for the collective good, of course, as he interpreted. So we have here a perfect example of Rand's notion of altruism. You might say, of course, the Nazis were especially extreme, but they were not extreme in the view that the purpose of morality is to sacrifice yourself for some collective. That was an extremely influential doctrine. We see, for example, the communists had an analogous view. What they said was that instead of saying that people should sacrifice themselves for the master race, they took a class interpretation of altruism rather than a racial one, as the Nazis did. So what they said is individual well-being should be subordinated to the goal of communist revolution. And to this end, people should be willing to sacrifice themselves for future generations. For example, during the 1930s and 40s, the communists were well aware that people who were living in the Soviet Union weren't in very good shape. They were had very low standards of living. Communism was supposed to be bringing this vastly more productive system than prevailed under capitalism. But it didn't appear to be working. So what the communists said was, well, you have to be willing to sacrifice yourself for the welfare of humanity, and this will come about in future. So here we have again an example of the kind of morality that Rand was concerned to attack, that the view is that, say, an individual who shouldn't say something like, well, you say that communism is this great system, but so why am I starving, or why am I living in an apartment with 10 other people? What's so great about that? The individual shouldn't think of what's best for him, but should be thinking, I have to sacrifice myself for the common good. We find that among some contemporary moral philosophers, for example, the late Oxford philosopher Jerry Cohen, G.A. Cohen, was an extremely sharp philosopher, said one criticism he had of capitalism was that this is a system based on greed, that really individuals should think they ought to, say, work extra hard to help the poor or less fortunate. They shouldn't have selfish motives like trying to get as much money as possible. We can also see this wasn't this altruistic view, wasn't, oh, I see somebody said, I thought the lecture sounded garbled. Well, that's probably just from the content of what I'm saying. I tend to be garbled. It's probably your sound system's working. Oh, I see it's all right now. Well, so much for my explanation. Okay, so it wasn't just what we consider very extreme groups like the communists and the Nazis who had this collectivist view. But we find that collectivist morality played a major role in World War I propaganda. The view there was that people could achieve moral regeneration by sacrificing themselves for a cause. We find a little earlier, say, in the book by Josiah Royce, who was one of the great American philosophers, a book called The Philosophy of Loyalty, where he said, well, the basis of morality is to select some group and then sacrifice yourself to that group. And we find that, say, in the war sonnets of Rupert Brooke, has anybody here read Rupert Brooke? He was a very famous poet who died during World War I. He said that he thought during war people were had the chance to sacrifice themselves for the community. In one of his poems, he compares going into war, he said, as swimmers into cleanness leaping, glad from a world grown old and cold and weary. Another poem of his is, somebody just sent me a message during a lecture asking, can I interrupt this? I hope they're not in the class, I'd say. Probably not right now. But so another of the sonnets, Rupert Brooke says, if I should die, think only this of me, that there is some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. So again, we have this notion of sacrifice. And again, just one other example. I'm giving you an example. This is a period I'm quite interested in. I think it shows, we look at the World War I time, we see the influence of this altruistic morality that Rand was so concerned to attack. Peter Taylor Forsyth, not sure the pronunciation, was one of the greatest British theologians of the time, the Congregationalist minister, wrote a book called The Justification of God, came out around the time World War I was going on. And he compared the sacrifice people make in war to Christ's sacrifice on the cross. Now, just continuing a bit with theology, I don't think this is really digression, because I'm just trying to illustrate the importance of this the altruistic doctrine that Rand is criticizing. During the 20th century, there was a very influential interpretation of Christianity that claimed that the New Testament taught self-sacrificial love for others as the basis of ethics. And probably the most comprehensive statement of that view is found in a book by the Swedish theologian, later bishop of the Swedish Lutheran Church, called Agape and Eros. This is the most comprehensive statement of this position. Has anybody here read that book or heard of it? Well, basically what Nygren argued was that in contrast to erotic love, where you're seeking in love something for yourself, agape, which is God's love, isn't trying to achieve anything. God isn't trying to achieve anything for himself. He's just giving to others, and this was the purest kind of love in the face of ethics, since he's very much in this altruistic line. And there was a counter to this among theologians that emphasized the teaching, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, where this is saying, well, you're supposed to love yourself too, because sure, you're supposed to love your neighbor, but you're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself. So at least if that isn't an egoistic, you could say you're not required to sacrifice yourself completely for others. And I'll just give one other example showing the influence today of altruism on contemporary philosophy. Is a famous argument by Peter Singer, who's an Australian philosopher and teaches at Princeton, who says we have a moral duty to give very large amounts of our wealth to help the poor all over the world to avoid death by disease and starvation. So basically it's a utilitarian argument. You can achieve a great good at not too much cost. Say you can give some of your money, while you'll be poorer, but you're still doing pretty well. But if you give the money to the poor, that'll enable them to live, so you'll be doing a great good for them, but so you should do that. So even if it's not in your own interest to give this money to the poor, you should still be willing to sacrifice substantial parts of your own money in order to do greater good for others. Now, there's a counter tradition to this view that ethics is based on altruism, self-sacrifice for others. And it's within this counter tradition that Rand's ethics is best viewed. And, this view really stems, these kind of stems from the Greek ethics, especially the ethics of Aristotle, also found in the Epicureans. So what this view holds is that the goal of ethics isn't how you sacrifice yourself for others or how you sacrifice yourself for the nation, but the basis of ethics is the individual's pursuit of the good life. And the term for this kind of term of flourishing, of happy, individual happiness, is eudaimonia, translating something like flourishing or happiness. And Ludwig von Mises places himself in this tradition. So he wasn't a follower of Rand. He knew Rand. He admired Atlas Shrugged. He wasn't a follower of her. But he also placed himself in the tradition of this Greek tradition, which said, you're not required in ethics just to sacrifice yourself for others. You're concerned with your own happiness. Now, I want to talk about this distinction between self-interested morality and collectivist or altruistic morality. But I now want to give another distinction that's different from that, but it's related to it. And this has to do with the reason we should be moral. Suppose we say, well, here are the requirements of morality, so you're not supposed to murder, you're not supposed to steal, you're supposed to give me all your money. You know, the standard requirements of morality. So you might say, well, why should I care about these? Why should I do that? Someone could say, well, here are the rules of morality, but what do I care about that? Now, one answer is that it's in one's interest to be moral, to your advantage to be moral. So that's why you should obey the rules of ethics. Now, since Rand thinks that the purpose of morality is to promote your own life, of course she's going to fit into this category, because she's going to be saying, well, the purpose of morality is to promote your own individual happiness, so why should you follow what morality says? Well, just because it's in your interest to do so. So for her, the purpose of morality, promoting your own happiness, lines up very directly with why you should care about morality. The purpose of morality is to promote your own well-being, and that's why you should care about morality. But there's another view. Remember the view we're now talking about, why should you care about, follow what morality says? Well, somebody says, well, here are the moral requirements. Why can't you just say, who cares about that? So the one view that I mentioned is that morality is in your interest. So obviously, people care about what's in their own interest. People want to be happy. So that's why you should care about morality. Now, there's another view, which is that morality just makes demands on you. It'd be something like, you have to do your duty, whether it's to your advantage to do so or not. It'd be something like, supposing, say, we have certain rules of logic. Suppose you say, why should I follow the rules of logic? Well, it might be that it's to your advantage to follow the rules of logic, because you get into all sorts of mishaps if you don't. But really, it wouldn't be right, I think, to say that you should follow rules of logic because it's to your advantage to do so. It's just these rules are rational requirements. They don't have some additional reason behind them. I mean, suppose we say, let's take one of the standard syllogisms that people always give in logic lectures. I give this in my logic lectures. Suppose we have all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. So suppose somebody says, well, why should I conclude from all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, that Socrates is mortal? You wouldn't answer that by giving the person some reason why it's to his advantage to believe that Socrates is mortal. You just say, look, this follows, this is a requirement of logic. So some people think morality is like that. It's just you have certain requirements. You have to do your duty, and the question whether it's to your advantage is a different question. It's just, here is the rules of morality, and that's it. And there's a very good, important article by the Oxford philosopher H.J. Pritchard, Harold Arthur Pritchard. It was called, Does Moral Philosophy Rest on a Mistake? This came out in Mind, the influential British philosophy journal, probably the top British philosophy journal. He said, does moral philosophy rest on a mistake? And he thought much moral philosophy did rest on a mistake. And the mistake was that it tried to give reasons for morality in terms of something else, thinking that it was to people's advantage to be moral. So he thought the question, why should you be moral, is a mistake. If you're asking for a reason to be moral, that's reducing morality to something else. So he said, well, look, morality just gives you certain requirements. It says you have to do such and such. It isn't that you have to do it because of something else. It just, here's what you have to do. So you see the two contrasting views. One says we should be moral, we should obey the rules of morality, because this is, it's in our interest to do, to obey those rules. And the other said, no, no, these are the rules. We just have to obey them. They have imperative force of their own. Now, note that this distinction that I've just given between saying that you should follow rules of morality because it's to your interest to do so, this is not in the other one that says the rules of morality are imperatives that you better do, whether you feel like doing them or not, or whether they're to your advantage or not. This isn't the same as the split between self-interested views and collectivist views of morality. Although, as I mentioned, for Rand, is a supporter of self-interested view of morality and also a self-interested view of motivation to be moral. But you don't have to have these two questions line up in that way. Somebody wasn't a collectivist. Let's say somebody accepts an egoist view of morality, said what you should do is promote your own interest. Somebody could say, well, the reason you should promote your own interest is not that it's in your interest to do that, even though it is, but you're required to do that. So on this, somebody could hold, although this would be an unusual position, that even if you felt like being a collectivist, even if that's what you really wanted to do, you shouldn't be. You should promote your own interests. This was a requirement of morality, and that didn't rest on anything else. So see the difference between these two questions. One is saying something like, what is the content of morality? Is it based on individual's development of his or her own life, or sacrifice to others, or possibly something else? And the other is the question, what is the reason we should be moral? Is it that it's to our advantage to be moral, or is it that morality is just imposes imperatives, and that we to ask for an official some reason to be moral is to make a mistake? Now, suppose, like Rand, you think that ethics aims to promote self-interest. that say each individual is trying to promote, ask what's best for him or what's best for her. So one might wonder, isn't this going to lead to a problem? Because let's suppose everybody became an objectivist. So everybody's saying, how can I, deciding questions, fundamental questions of living, by saying, how can I promote my own interests? So isn't this going to lead to conflict? Because what if my interest isn't in conflict with yours? So aren't people going to be fighting all the time? So won't an egoist ethics then break down, because each person will be concerned with his own well-being, but they'll just end up getting in each other's way? Now this here, the answer is, I think, is an absolutely fundamental point if we're going to understand Rand's ethics, is that Rand thought that people's interests should be interests rather than interests in singular, or in fundamental harmony. So people advance their own interests by cooperating with each other, not with each other, not by fighting with them. So really, so I'm aiming to promote, let's take an example, I'm aiming to promote my own interest. So if I'm following Rand's ethics, the reason I'm giving this lecture, it's to my advantage to do so. I'm getting a certain amount of money for giving the lecture, so that's why I'm doing it. But in doing that, it's my and say you're attending the lecture because you think that it's in your interest to learn something about Rand's ethics. So it isn't though, even though it's in my interest to give the lecture, but it's not in my interest, say, to do kind of as little as possible in preparing the lecture so I maximize the amount of money I get for the amount of time I'm putting into preparing the lecture. On the contrary, it's in my interest to do the best I can in giving you good a lecture as I'm able to do. So my interest here is in cooperating with you. I'm trying to do what I can if I have a reasonable view of my own interest. And people really don't advance their interests by trying to harm one another, but by cooperating with each other. And as we'll see, this is the principal theme of Atlas Shrugged, that it's based on an egoist ethic, but it's one in which people advance their interests by cooperation, social cooperation in the free market, not by some kind of Hobbesian state of nature where people are fighting one another. Life, as Hobbes says, is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And this is, for those of you who are familiar with Ludwig von Mises, you'll remember this is the basic theme of Mises' ethics, that because in a free market, everyone benefits from the free market, even people who aren't very skilled benefit by exchanging with others, and the skilled people benefit by trading with them rather than trying to produce everything by themselves. So everybody benefits from the free market. So even though people in the free market are trying to advance their own interests, we benefit by cooperation. Now let's look at a bit in how this theme of egoist ethics that leads to cooperation plays out in Atlas Shrugged. I can probably maybe the most important thing to remember about the ethics of the novel is that we look at the activities of the people the heroes and heroines of the book, the creators, people like Dagny, Taggart, Hank Reardon, Francisco Danconi, of course John Galt himself, they're creators, they're coming up with new products like the Reardon steel, but their activities help other people because other people now have the products available to them. They couldn't, the masses lack the creative ability to come up with all these new products, but we all benefit from the activities of the great creators. So even though the creators are motivated by developing their own creative powers, they're not saying, how can I help the masses as much as possible? The result of their activities is to help the masses. And it's clear from the book that Rand has very low regard for the masses, people that are going along with all these government interventionist measures, and even people like Eddie Willers, who is kind of a well-meaning, good person, isn't portrayed with an enormous amount of sympathy. But even though Rand regards the masses without much esteem, they still benefit from the activities of the creators. So her view then is egoism with harmony. Very often when people think of egoist ethics, they would have the view of something like someone who's just kind of selfish and kind of the popular sense of someone who's self-seeking and doesn't care about other people at all. I think I've given you my great friend Jim Sadowski likes to say, I like to get to dessert first ahead of all the greedy and selfish people. So that kind of popular view of egoism, that you're just trying to grab as much as possible for yourself and who cares about anybody else. But this isn't what Rand is favoring. Rather, it's a view that each person is trying to advance his own interest, but the way we can do that is to cooperate with others through peaceful exchange on the free market. Now, how does Rand try to argue for her egoist ethics? Well, she starts off by asking, why does the institution of ethics and morality exist? Why is there such a thing as ethics and morality? And she finds the answer, perhaps surprisingly, in biology. She says that animals survive by instinct, so animals automatically do what's required to ensure their survival. So I noticed something, just to give you one kind of crude example. The other day I saw in the sink there was a cockroach. I don't like cockroaches much, so I was trying to get rid of it. And I see, as soon as I moved to hit the cockroach with something, it immediately moves away. They can move away faster than I can get to them. So when they're doing that, they're not thinking, oh, well, here's some funny-looking person who might hit me. They just do it automatically. But human beings aren't like that. According to Rand, and this is a kind of very controversial, she doesn't think human beings have instincts at all. But whether she's right about that or not, she's certainly right that we don't have instincts that completely dictate our behavior, and we have to rely on reason in order to live. We have to be able to decide things. Things aren't given to us automatically if we want to survive. So, in her view, the fact that human beings need to use reason in order to survive gives us the point and purpose of ethics. In what sense is that case? Well, she characterized the value as what one acts to gain or keep. So anything you're trying to get counts as a value for you. So the question would be, well, what sort of values should we try to gain? What is it that we should try to gain or keep? And she thinks the point we just discussed, namely the fact that human beings need to use reason or survive, tells us what we should act to gain or keep. So question ethics is, what are the appropriate values? Or value is something we should act to gain or keep. So the answer comes from realizing that we need to use reason in order to survive. So think about what we need to survive will tell us what the appropriate values are, what we need to what we should act to gain or to keep. Now, in viewing ethics this way, this leads her to an opinion on one of the most important controversies in ethics, which is whether morality is objective. Now, objective here doesn't mean according to objectivism. So, of course, is morality objectivist? That would just be, well, in her system it is, because she is an objectivist, but in non-objective system, the answer would be no. But here what we mean something else that's a bit confusing. Here when I talk about objective, it does not mean according to objectivist philosophy. But here, the way most philosophers take this question is morality objective. The question would mean, can moral judgment be true or false? Well, I say murder is wrong. Is that a statement that's true or false? If I say something like, I'm now giving a lecture, that's a true statement. Suppose you take the same thing, I'm giving a lecture an hour from now. I hope that's a false statement. If it turns out to be true, it means I would have gone way over time. But the question is, are moral judgments true or false just in that way? Now, some people say no, and those people are called subjectivists. So what would they be saying? Well, suppose I like vanilla ice cream, but you don't. Say you like some other kind of ice cream, don't like ice cream or not. We couldn't say, I think, that either of us is correct or incorrect. It's just some people, including me, like vanilla ice cream, other people don't, and that's all you can really say about it. You can't say liking vanilla ice cream is something that's true or false. It's just some people like it and some don't. So some people think that moral judgments are like that. They would say most people would accept the statement murder is wrong, but it doesn't follow from that murder is wrong is true in something either identical or like the way factual judgments are true or false. It's just all that we have in morality is certain preferences. So that's a big issue in moral theory. Now, Rand counts as a believer in objectivity in the way I just distinguished. She thought it wasn't just a matter of opinion that the purpose of ethics is for each person's own survival. Remember, she's saying human beings need to use reason in order to survive. We don't operate by instinct. So this tells us what values we should act to gain and keep, mainly the ones that will promote our own survival. So she thinks that answer isn't just her opinion or preference. She thinks this is true in a straightforward sense. So she thinks, suppose you say, no, you ought to sacrifice yourself for other people. She thinks that's a false claim. It isn't just that some people prefer to be egoists and others prefer to be altruists. She thinks her view is the correct one. Now, although she thinks that her view is objectively true, she separates her version of objectivity from another position, which I kind of name, I find a bit of a tongue twister, intrinsicism. So we'll get to what this is right away, but objectivity in her view does not imply the truth of intrinsicism. Now, what is this position? This very important to understand because intrinsicism is one of her principal enemies in both ethics and metaphysics. And so intrinsicism is something you should avoid, at least if you accept what she said. Now, many philosophers who accept moral objectivity reason in this way. They say, well, if morality is objectively true, that to say, the statements of morality, judgments of morality like murder is wrong, are true statements and not just preferences that we have. It isn't just, you say murder is wrong, it doesn't mean just I disapprove of murder, but we're saying that there's something that's true, there's something out there that's true. And they say, well, then the propositions of morality aren't up to us. So then they say, well, if these propositions of morality aren't up to us, then their truth holds independently of us. Murder is wrong to be true, even if, let's imagine, some kind of mad scientist injected some drug into us to make us think that murder is all right. It would still be the case, even if everybody came to believe that murder is all right, it would still be the case that murder is wrong. So then now here's the crucial step that gets you to intrinsicism, is that some philosophers think that things are valuable regardless of our relations to them. So something that can be either good or bad, regardless of how that thing is related to other people. The great British philosopher G.E. Moore, who's one of the greatest theorists of ethics in the 20th century, said that a beautiful object would be valuable even in a universe without conscious beings. So imagine, say, all consciousness wiped out, or we still have, say, all the beautiful pictures in the museum, he said they'd still be beautiful even nobody would be able to look at them or think about them. So beauty is an intrinsic property of objects. It's just something they have regardless of their relations to other people. Now, as you could, I'm sure, figure out from what I've said already, Rand rejected intrinsicism. I don't mean you could figure it out because I said Rand rejects intrinsicism. You should be able to see why her view requires that. Because remember, what she's saying is that the point of ethics is to advance your own interest. So she's saying, again, we don't operate on instincts, we have to depend on reason in order to survive. So by the use of our reason, we can figure out what we need to survive. And this tells us what we should value in the sense of what we should aim to gain or keep. So things in this view aren't good or bad just in themselves, just regardless of how they're related to others, but a value is what promotes someone's life. Now, one thing, again, this I mentioned this a little before, but when I've been talking about moral objectivity, again, this is the issue of whether moral judgments are true or false. And like I said, Rand counts as someone who believes in objectivity, even though she rejects intrinsicism in many people who, many philosophers who accept objectivity also accept intrinsicism, but she doesn't. But the important thing, to avoid confusing, is that when Rand is talking about objectivism in morals, she's talking about her own position. She doesn't mean to include other moral theories that take moral judgments to be true or false. For example, an altruist theory, one that says you should sacrifice yourself, say, for the nation or for the church, could be an objective theory in the sense that people who advocate that say that isn't just their own preference, they think it's really the case you ought to do that. But of course, it wouldn't qualify as an objectivist system in her sense. So she takes her objectivist view to be in between subjectivism and intrinsicism. Here for one, she's advocating something between the extremes. So a subjectivist view would say, all that we have in ethics is my preferences or your preferences. An intrinsicist view that would say, there are things that are good or bad regardless of how people related to those things think some states of affairs just are good or bad, and that's all there is to it. But her view is some things are good or bad for people. That's not something they decide according to their own preferences. Say, if something will promote my survival, then that's objectively true that that will promote my survival. But there are things that are good or bad apart from their relation to people. So intermediate between subjectivism and intrinsicism. Now, continuing with her own view, she thinks that everyone has a basic choice in life, which is whether to live or die. So suppose you don't choose to live. Unfortunately, there are people who don't. So then, in her view, no other choices have a rational basis. If I don't choose to live, no other choice has a rational basis. And why not? Well, because in her system, the values of what will promote your own life. So if you don't choose to live, you're lacking in necessary conditions for all other choices. And she tries to support this by imagining, she says, if we didn't have a choice to live or die, nothing could matter to us. And she tries to support this by famous example, the immortal robot, which is, suppose there were some robot that was conscious but couldn't be destroyed. So she thinks, well, nothing would matter to it because nothing could destroy it. I must say, I don't find that too plausible. I mean, couldn't a robot care about what if it turned out that some things would be, even though the robot would never be destroyed, some things would be extremely painful to it or give it pleasure, couldn't care about that or couldn't make things it liked and didn't like. But she finds this a very plausible example, and I should say many of her followers do too, and they don't accept objections of the kind I just sketched out. Now, suppose we do choose to live, then what we're choosing, in her view, is not bare physical survival, but survival is a rational being, because that's what we are, we're rational beings. So suppose there were some ways that I could take some kind of pill and it would just put me into a coma, but let's say I'd last for about 150 years, say the scientists have figured out some way to preserve me. I'd still be living, but somehow I would be immune to various sorts of diseases, so I'd be just going on for a very long time. That wouldn't be something for a system to say you should do, because even though you'd be surviving, you wouldn't be surviving as a rational being. Now, as you would expect, each person chooses to live and to subordinate his life to some collective. But remember, her view is egoism with harmony. So when you're pursuing your own good, you have to respect the rights of others to make the same choice whether to live or not in their own lives. And parasitism, which is you don't live productively, but you live, you sort of act, you just live off other people, is something that she doesn't accept. So this is, again, kind of egoism. Each person is trying to live a productive life, and they're all cooperating with each other. Okay, well, I think we'll stop there. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to open the Q&A box. You can either type your question in there, but I'll keep the chat on open there so you can put your questions, comments, objections, and so on there, and I'll try to answer or evade them as seems best. Okay, so we have here, someone says, I don't see the Stefan Molyneux Guide for My Sins t-shirt. Who? Never heard of him. Okay, Malcolm asks, how did Epicurus differ from Aristotle? What would Epicurus have in common with and differ from Austrian? Well, Epicurus had the views called Epicureanism, is something like what you should be doing in life is maximizing your own pleasure. So this is different from Aristotle, where Aristotle thinks, well, you're trying to live, flourish, but it isn't that you're trying to maximize pleasure. And the way Epicurus thought you should try to do that is not, as you might expect, well, just going in for all sorts of exciting activities, but you should try to minimize tension in your life. You should kind of just live a kind of a calm life. So you say, next part is, what would Epicurus have in common with and differ from Austrian? Well, remember, Austrianism is a theory of economics. It doesn't directly imply any ethical conclusion. So Mises actually saw himself in this, as mentioned in the lecture, some demonist tradition where you say, well, what is the reason, what's the point of ethics to promote well-being rather than saying, here are the ethical rules, that's all there is to it. But he listed Epicurus as one of the people in that tradition, but it isn't specifically an Epicurean, Mises views aren't specifically Epicurean in character. Okay, Malcolm asked another one. What was Rand's view of someone using nature in a way that produces something that produces pollution, even toxic pollution at the expense of your breathe or water we drink? What were her views of externality? Well, Rand's not I don't think she really wrote much or anything I can call on that topic. I think she would say, property rights have to be defined properly. We don't have the right to pollute spread pollution to other people. But I think she tended to be, in her own work, very critical of the environmentalist movement. She thought the environmentalists or the Greens were people who were trying to overthrow capitalism, which was the basis of civilization. So Purview doesn't commit her to saying something like you can produce as much pollution as you like, or pollution isn't, she isn't, wouldn't deny that pollution is a bad thing, but she tended to be in practice to be very critical of environments with claims that various sorts of pollution was going on. She would be very negative about it. And if you look at, say, the work of her friend and follower, George Reisman, in his long book, Capitalism, he has a very elaborate attack on the environmentalist movement. So I think you could get her view, his, but he said there would be an accord with her view. Now, Wesley said, oh, good, Wesley, for once, doesn't have a comment on my mustache or hairdo. I'm surprised it's a real Wesley. Wesley said, would you say that objectivism flows together with Mises' classical liberalism? Well, I think they're certainly compatible views, but Mises had a rather different view of ethics from Rand. Mises was, at least in his theory of ethics, was a subjectivist. He didn't think that ethical judgments are true and false in this way that I'm talking about, the moral objectivity, except he was saying rather that he said ethical judgments are just expressions of preference, but he thinks in fact that almost everyone will have certain preferences, namely that everyone wants peace and prosperity. So he said, well, it isn't objectively true that peace and prosperity are better than war and poverty. It's just that's what people in fact want. So so that's the difference between him and Rand. I think in the conclusion, they tend, objectivism and classical liberalism tend to be quite a bit in accord, but the way they get there is somewhat different. Now, Kathy asks, aren't people's interests determined by their own fundamental beliefs? If so, doesn't egoist ethics only work if people's fundamental beliefs are in harmony? Well, I think, you see, Rand, I don't think, would accept that. I mean, what would be a good way of showing this? Both, in her view, it's in your interest to survive as a rational being, to develop your own abilities and powers as a rational being. Now, supposing, in fact, you're living in a society that says, well, what you should be doing is sacrificing yourself for the state, say, growing up in a communist society, and that's what they teach you. So you would have the belief that you should sacrifice yourself for others. So it wouldn't follow on Rand's view that people in such a society it isn't in people's interest in such a society to develop their own rational power, just because they don't realize it. Now, on your other part of the question, I don't think you're right that people's interests depend on their beliefs, because people could be mistaken about their interests in her view. But the system, and here I think you're quite very perceptive when you say, the system won't work if people don't accept egoist ethics. So if you look at Atlas Shrugged, which we're personally doing in this course, it's really in the interest, say, of the ones who are running the Science Institute and the ones, the government, the businessmen who are acting against, say, Jimmy Taggart. It's really in their interest to behave in ethically egoist way, but they don't bear have these collectivist views, and they're acting against their own interests because they do that, that going to prevent the egoist system from working properly. So if they get their way, then the free market won't work, it will all collapse. Now, James says, did Rand not accept the paradox that sacrifice can be for one's individual benefit and enjoyment by gift giving, etc.? Well, this is a very good question you asked, James. And you see, when Rand talks about sacrifice, she means something like, I think she defines it there as giving up a value you take to be superior to one that's of lesser value. So supposing you admire someone and you give him or her a gift, that would be perfectly appropriate in her view. Just what's ruled out is, say, that you're required to sacrifice yourself for others, whether you value the others or not. So if you value the others, as you think this is something that's part of developing your own life is to help certain other people, that would be perfectly all right. Now, this does raise an issue which might be point to some tension in your view, that she could define something as being a value for you in such a broad way that ordinary things would think it's ordinarily as altruistic behavior count as egoistic on her system. For example, as I think I mentioned before, we look at Francisco D'Anconia in the novel. Even though he's in love with Dagny, he doesn't show this because he thinks it's better for the Gaul's court cause not to show this, to pretend to be a worthless playboy. So he's not acting in a conventionally egoist way, but this is all right, or at least even praiseworthy in Rand's system. Patricia said, while reading Atlas Shrugged, I noticed a lot of parallels between the book and my own country. Do you think Ayn Rand's book fostered a time that she was able to understand the drivers of human being civilization as a whole? Well, I think she had views that, if she's right, certainly applied to more than the United States at the time she was writing. She doesn't tend her system to be a universally valid philosophy. Whether it is or not is a different point, but she certainly intended her thought in that way. Now, Maury says, is it possible there's no middle ground between ethics of self-interest and sacrifice of self-interest? Like, there's no middle ground between the free market and socialist. In a sense, once you act based in the belief of self-sacrifice, sacrificial, I think she and her followers would say that real, I think I did try to cover that bit in the lecture, is that they would say, if you're not fully egoist, then you're at least admitting, and in some situations, you would be willing to subordinate your own well-being to something else, so that makes you at least somewhat altruistic. Okay, now Leslie says, what does Singer say about economists such as P.T. Bauer have argued that foreign aid has been detrimental to people in developing countries? I don't think he's ever addressed P.T. Bauer, who's a very good writer. I don't think he would have to reject what Bauer is saying. I think he would just say, well, certainly various foreign aid programs might turn out to be wasteful, but you should then just give the money to people, like give it directly to them, or don't go through the government in a way that helps those people. Say, instead of having government tax you and then letting the money go to all sorts of wasteful projects or into the pockets of people in the less developed country government who are just trying to amass wealth and stuff, or just give the money direct to the poor we need it to survive. So I don't think what he would be saying would have to be incompatible with Bowers. I don't think, as far as I know, I don't think he ever wrote on that. And I just see one, Bob just asked before concluding, John, can you say something about how and if we'll make up the loss lecture? Oh, well, there won't, you'll get your full quota of six lectures, just that we skipped a week last week, so we're just adding another lecture. So the course won't be ending on the date originally scheduled. I think we had one, I think we had two stops. There was one that was for the July 4th holiday, and one last week for the Mises Youth. So the course will be ending just a couple weeks after the time schedule. So the lectures will just be made up in the sense that they'll just be going on at the regularly scheduled time through the extra couple of weeks, so you won't be missing anything. Now, Leslie said, I've asked you this question before, but would you say that basically developing your own ethical code at Ransford is the basis for non-religious views in libertarianism? Well, I just think the next question that's fine, right, is, say, everyone, I think, is trying to think out what is interesting in the mass, trying to develop a way of asking what is the basis of ethics, but it wouldn't follow from the fact you're thinking about the basis of ethics for yourself, you're going to have to come up with a non-religious answer. That would just be dependent on what view you said you came up with. So it would just vary with the view you come up with. I don't think the project of trying to develop an ethical, think about basic ethics would imply you're trying to just work out a separate ethical code for yourself, or it would have to be non-religious. And I see one here from Malcolm. Please could you comment on why you think the left in America dislike Ransford? You mentioned environmentalists, but the left is made up of other segments. Well, I think one thing was Rand in Atlas Shrugged and other books, and it went right in the face of the leftists. In that, say, if we look at other people who write on the free market, say, people like Mises, other very prominent people at Mises, who'd say Milton Friedman. What those people will be saying is something like the free market is best for everybody. So something like Milton Friedman is one who says, well, he says, I accept the goals of the left-wing people. Maybe Mises wasn't the best example, but let's take Milton Friedman says, well, I believe in equality too, just like you do. But the best way to achieve that is not through socialism, but through the free market. Then Mises says, is not an egalitarian, but he says something like, look, the leftist, look, if you want to achieve the measure you propose, will fail from the point of view of the goals you yourself have. So you shouldn't support minimum wage laws because they won't have the results of helping the poor. So this type of argument for the free market is one that it is not directly challenging the leftist goals. It's not saying equality is or something or helping the workers is bad. But Rand did that. She said we shouldn't help the face value isn't helping other people. So this, I think, really shocks a lot of people. Something like, she's not just saying, well, if you want to help the poor, you should support the free market, but she doesn't think it's really that big a deal to help the poor. She, in fact, thinks, I mean, she's not completely doesn't break with traditional news to the extent you think, well, who cares if the poor, it's a good thing that the poor don't do well. She thinks, in fact, the poor will do much better under the free market than under other systems, but she doesn't really care all that much about that. So that really bothers the left. The leftist, of course, I'm not saying she's right to hold that view, but that is her view. And that the leftist wishes that you could go in a stash like, here's, I'll just buy one in the store. That's what I do. Now, Patricia says parallels are also evident in Argentina. Not only the U.S., but some other countries, I wouldn't doubt it. Maury says, I think the left is right, then because they're in love with the idea of altruism, so you sacrifice yourself to me and my specialty. Yes, I think that's quite compatible with what I was saying. Yes, and Jay, collectively, versus individualism. Okay, and Nathan, if you read the article, Defending Capitalism Against Iran on LouRaffle.com, I think it appeared to. I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to look at that and maybe we'll try to comment on it the next time. I actually should have read that because Ralph Rako sent me a copy of it before it appeared on LouRaffle, but I had a lot of work to do, and I just got back from the Mises U, and I had to get my daily article out, so I didn't have time really to go into that yet, but I'll try to get to it. Now, Wesley said, do you think the Rand's viewpoint, I answered that way on space for non-religious viewpoints. Well, I mean, it would certainly be a non-religious view, but I mean, there are other views you could take that are non-religious also, that are non-Randian. Patricia says, with Atlas Shrugged prohibited in many countries like we, I have to look into that. I suspect it wasn't a bestseller in the Soviet Union, but I had to check into that. Unless he says, you write on the Raffle site as well. Yes, I haven't had anything recently, although sometimes we print my reviews on Mises.org, but I have in the past written a whole lot of articles for them. You can just, if you go to the site, you just check, click on columnist and look for my name. I hope to do more for them in the future. Wes says, what did you think of Bet People? That's interesting you ask that. I have a review of that, I think, scheduled to appear Thursday, so you'll find out. I'm curious, did you know that was coming out, or was there some special reason you asked that? I just asked you because it was interesting you asked that when the review was just scheduled to come out. Or maybe because, did I mention it before the class started? I don't remember. Oh, you knew it was, oh, you're acquainted with Pete. Oh, but that raises the question, how did he know it was coming out? Because I didn't mention it to him. Maybe he heard about it from Joe Salerno, who knows it. I would say it's a somewhat mixed review. I like certain things, but oh, you knew about the book coming out. I think you just wondered what it would be. Why not? You just thought maybe it's likely I'm going to review it. Well, you're quite right. I mean, I did review it. I was reading it in part when I was at the Mises U on the plane, so. Certainly an interesting book, but you'll see the review. As I say, it's kind of a mixed review. There's something I like it, and that is, I find I disagree with it. Wesley says, how much do you charge to come speak at events? If people ask me to speak, I mean, it's very nice of them. And I do most of my speaking for the Mises Institute, so you know, I mean, that is just part of my job. You know, there isn't a separate fee. Now, Leslie says, did Rand anticipate the concept of color of youth on his theory of knowledge? I don't even think serious enough that the mind has covered space and has already enabled us to make sense of experience. Well, I think it raises a very good point. I think her interpretation of Kant is one that could be questioned, but I don't know whether her criticism of Kant stemmed from criticism of her ethics. I suspect, remember, on her view, it's the metaphysics and theory of knowledge that's primary, so I think her basic criticism of Kant, or she was against him for such an altruistic ethic, but her basic criticism of Kant was that in her view, he denied us access to reality in this world. So she thought that was really what made him one of the most evil, if not most evil, thinkers of all time. I think a lot of views on Kant stem from the follower Leonard Peikoff. I think she had independently, and she thought Kant was a bad guy, but Peikoff confirmed her in her negative view of him. Okay, well, we have time for at least one more if anyone has anything. Anybody else there? Somebody has here. Tim says Robert Wenzel had a pretty great interview. I think I agree with you. I like that interview, but I think I'd better avoid discussing this person that's gotten me into more trouble than it's worth already. So I'll just leave them out. We fooled him. Everybody. So thanks very much for coming to my lecture. Hope we'll see you all next week. So thanks a lot, everybody. Goodbye.